Welcome to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look, where you, the investor, get to listen as Chris Perry grills the best and the brightest in the corporate sector to help you find out who's the wheat and who's the chaff. Listen in.
My name is Chad Sykes. I'm currently the CEO of Indoor Harvest Corp, and the ticker symbol is INQD. I just recently issued a shareholder letter that puts a lot of good information out there, and that's who we are.
If you could summarize in 25 words or less where that letter sees your company right now, how would you describe it?
We are in a transitionary phase, basically restructuring. We've developed two very promising business verticals. But the two verticals, one's cannabis, one's produce, and the investor risk between the two just is not compatible. Mm-hmm. So we've come to the conclusion the company needs to be separated, split in half, basically. So the plan right now that we're pursuing is to spin off the vertical farming side of our company to our shareholders. And then the remaining company, the assets of the cannabis side, will remain in the public vehicle. And we are now looking to combine other organizations to create a pharmaceutical group.
Okay.
I will be stepping down as CEO of Indoor Harvest, which would be the company that would be spun out, and will be taking the role of Chief Technology Officer. And then my partner and co-founder, Mr. John Chu, will be taking over the role of CEO.
Okay.
That's pretty much the gist of the letter.
So Indoor Harvest is in a space that, for me, has always been one where I feel like it should be doing a lot better than it is. I think vertical farming makes perfect sense in a world where food security is a problem, especially in a country like the United States, where in urban areas there are food deserts, as it's called, where people just can't get fresh produce. It seems to me like that should be a sector that is just blowing the roof off. Yet there's a lot of companies that have kind of struggled their way through or invested a lot of money in technology that hasn't necessarily paid them back yet. Where do you think Indoor Harvest is on its trajectory? Is it where it should be? Is it below where it should be? Is it the market just not recognizing? The stock's certainly been doing well lately, but overall, how do you sort of see the sector?
So we ourselves had to pivot a few times in that sector. The industry basically, for the most part, has sort of moved forward with this franchise license model. You know, it's a lot of investment money that goes into developing these processes. And so a lot of these guys that have put a lot of money into these businesses, they're trying to get it back out. So they're rushing, they're jumping to doing licensing and franchising, for mm-hmm. example, a lot like the Aero Farms, Green Sense Farms, all these groups. At the end of the day, they're trying to, in essence, franchise or license out the methods that they've developed.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, though, is the space, the technology in the space and the processes themselves are developing so rapidly that every day there's a new innovation that's coming mm-hmm. out, and it's changing that. And so we recognized that early on, and one of our first big major pivots was to pivot away from that model of basically trying to sell, here's a piece of equipment that we sell, and a process. And we moved more towards an engineering, procurement, and construction management company.
Okay.
At the end of the day, what that allows us to do there is just sort of grow with the industry, learn all the new technologies, and adapt them to the platforms that we've developed. So what we do a little bit differently than everybody else in the space is while everybody has mainly invested into actual production facilities, so they've got actual farms that they can point to and say, here's our farm, here's our proof of concept, if you will, and now we're trying to license and franchise it. Instead of building that farm, we've just continually dumped money into the R&D side. And one of the ways we've been able to stretch our dollars is that we've partnered with other groups that are doing research where we basically provide them low-cost equipment and support and in order to get that data back. Because at the end of the day, the big important thing for us is data. I mean, it's mm-hmm. not technology. Technology is there. Mm-hmm. What's really needed is the data, and we don't have enough at-scale data right now. So to answer your question, we pivoted towards more of a construction company and moved away from actually running and operating farms.
So I see that evidence of that in your second quarter results back in August, where you've got a fairly low revenue for that quarter, but you've also got a note of a pipeline there that stretches into the potential tens of millions of dollars. Since August, how has that pipeline moved? Are you finding it that you're progressing in that, or is it thinning out, or what's the deal?
Oh, yeah. The deal flow that we have right now is off the charts would be the best way to frame it. I mean, anybody can look in the industry in the vertical farming space, and if they do their due diligence, they'll find out that we're one of only a handful of companies that even offer the services that we do. We're getting inundated with constant deal flow. So the pipeline has gotten bigger. We do have one of our big projects getting a little bit delayed because we're coming up into the winter months. So a lot of the projects that we're starting to see are up in the northeast United States, they're up in Canada. And now that we're getting into the winter months, you're going to have frozen ground, so groundwork's going to get delayed, things like that. So we don't sell, like a lot of companies, we don't sell like products and widgets. We're actually developers of complete construction projects ground up. So on the engineering side, we don't really make a lot of money.
Okay.
You know, that's not really where the money's at. The money is in the actual construction. So I would say most of these projects are not really going to be kicking off until after the winter. And the other problem is for us as a company, especially with a public company, is, and you may be familiar with how GAAP accounting and stuff works, but we have to use the work in progress accounting method.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we've got big books signed contracts, and these are real projects that we put engineering work into and we're working with these clients, you know, we have to book it as work in progress. So until we're actually drawing the big draws and we're doing the construction, even though we have the signed contract, it doesn't necessarily show up. It's not like a normal situation. So you're having to do basically this work in progress accounting. So you won't really see a huge bump in revenue until, you know, next year probably.
Got it. And I see that in the same document that I was looking at where you've got three projects that are currently in various stages of completion. But the upfront costs on that, or upfront revenue on that, is relatively small, and until it's completed, you don't get that big
whack. A lot of it's engineering, and you know, it's and in many situations, the clients are at different phases of their development of themselves. I mean, you know, some of them have their full capital stack, some of them don't have their full capital stack, some of them are having zoning and permitting issues. I mean, it's construction. There's not a construction project out there that doesn't get delayed at some point. So, you know, we're facing all those same issues that any construction company does.
Sure. And looking at that pipeline, it's almost a steady split between produce projects and cannabis projects. I've always been a little confused in the cannabis side as to how vertical farming can work beyond just the cloning stage. Explain to me, if you will, like how a vertical farm can be used for cannabis, like right through the grow, if that can be.
Vertical farming in and of itself is just simply layering crops to maximize your floor space. So in that situation, you know, you could be using relatively common flood and drain drip irrigation production methods and just stack them up on shelves, basically. Yeah, what we do is goes a little bit beyond just layering and stacking plants. But with our technology, we don't use a technology similar to what the industry is currently using. So most production methods are either a flood and drain where they would have plants are growing like a rock wool or cocoa, or they have a drip irrigation. Those are basically hydroponic methods. And then you have outdoor soil. But what we do is we atomize the water and the nutrients to an aerosol, about a 50 micron aerosol. And this was developed by NASA in the 1990s. And so what we're seeing with our method, our production method, which we can layer, it can be built vertical or it can be built single layer. It doesn't really matter how you build it. But what our process does is it reduces the cost of cultivation by about 80%. While increasing actual biomass or plant material output as high as 150%. And then some of the R&D that was done at Canopy Growth or at Tweed with our last pilot, in some situations, now not the whole platform, but in certain specific situations with some of the plants that they were testing, they got as much as a 90% increase in flower yield. And overall, we tend to see about a 40-45% increase in flower yield. So it's not the same kind of technology, and it does require an infrastructure investment. And getting the technology to adopt in the U.S. is a completely different animal than trying to get it to adopt in say, a place like Canada, where it's federally legal.
Sure.
Because in the U.S., you've got more of a short-term ROI mindset because of the regulatory framework. So
yeah.
Something like our platform is definitely an infrastructure investment. It's not something as simple as throwing some flood tables up and some high-pressure sodium light.
for sure.
So it is a bit more complex, but the return on investment is quite high.
So I live in a place in just outside of Vancouver called Richmond, which has traditionally been a very agricultural part of town. But as time has moved forward and suburbs have become cities, there's this constant pressure between people who want to protect the farmland because we need to have food close by, and those who say, look, the farmland is worth too much money to be growing lettuce on. How quickly do you think we're going to get to a place where vertical farming and urban farming just becomes the norm rather than the innovation exception?
It's really going to be geographic and market dependent.
Okay.
So I'm the first person in the vertical farming industry that will jump up and say very quickly that vertical farming is not going to work everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's really going to depend on the market and the crop that you're trying to grow, the cost of energy, the climate. I mean, all of these things are going to play into, you know, knowing whether or not a vertical farm will work or not.
Mm-hmm.
My personal view is there is a market for the smaller owner-operator model that are growing sort of the gourmet leafy greens and herbs and things like that. There's definitely a great market for that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still a pretty good ways away from the big, huge sort of science fiction vertical farms that are 20 stories tall and they're supplying a whole city with food. We're not there anywhere near that yet. So
right.
Where vertical farming really shines today is in providing high-end, high-value, consistent quality crops to people that need a higher value of product, like a restaurant or something like that, in an owner-operator model, or pharmaceuticals. I think there's a really huge opportunity for vertical farming, more so on the pharmaceutical side. But generally speaking, vertical farming will only work in areas where the energy, the climate, and the market demand, that formula will work. You know, it's not going to work everywhere. So.
Sure. So when I first heard about indoor harvest, I was I got your information from Alan Brockstein. And, you know, we were talking before this interview, he's not necessarily the biggest fan of indoor harvest. But explain to me, if you will, where you think he's got it wrong.
Well, I think as an analyst, I think he's maybe looking at the revenue side a bit more than the IP and technology side. I really don't know. I mean, I can't say that somebody's got it wrong. I mean, everybody's got their flavor of investment and what they look for in their criteria. So I can't necessarily say somebody's wrong in their opinion, depending on what their criteria is. The only thing that I could say to somebody in terms of analyzing the company is we have 5 years of R&D development. We've done numerous third-party technology pilots and worked with some major universities, and our technology is disruptive to the cannabis industry. I mean, it truly is disruptive. And the only problem is the legal framework in the United States and the lack of investment capital, or I should say the lack of investor interest in deploying large infrastructure, does sort of hamper us in the U.S. market. I will be the first to admit that. But the technology is developed, it's mature, and it's only going to get better as we develop more on top of it. And I'm not aware of really anybody that's pursuing this level of infrastructure development. So in that respect, I mean, you know, I think the IP or the technology that we've developed gets sort of not looked at as closely because there's not a lot out there about it. And one of the reasons there's not a lot about the technology out there is because it's still very much in development.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can't be out there sharing all the little nuts and bolts that we're doing. So,
right, for sure.
I think as far as on the cannabis side, which would be more what Alan Brockstein as an analyst is looking at,
mm-hmm.
I think that opinions and perceptions will change once we're able to show the results out of our economic pilot that we're setting up right now, because then that's going to give the baseline of what the system's ROI is. And I think when people start to do the math and see the results, it's going to be impressive.
So one of the things that Brockstein put out there that I think has been picked up by a lot of people, or at least the perception that's been put out by a lot of people, is that recently Chuck Raffici came in and took a piece of your company, which coincidentally also the point where suddenly the stock started launching into multiples. Did he save the company, quote-unquote, or did he just make a savvy investment?
I mean, I wouldn't say he saved the company. I don't know if that's the right word to use. I mean, Mr. Rafici is an investor like any of our other investors.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of that, I mean, he's a note holder.
Right.
He came in and provided us capital and helped us refinance some debt. So in terms of that, I mean, we had a deal go south. The Head North deal did go south on us, which kind of put us in a little bit of a bind there, short notice. But at the end of the day, Chuck, Mr. Rafici just is another note holder that came in and helped refinance some of our debt.
He's kind of like the Frank Giustra to lithium of, you know, he is to cannabis. Like, as soon as he gets involved in a company, it seems like that company starts to take off. At your side of things, watching the stock move as it is right now, do you feel like it's just getting to where it should be? Or, you know, is there a little bit of exuberance out there with California's referendum coming up? You know, do you see this as the right price? Do you see it as still undervalued?
I'll let the market decide the value. I don't really, you know, I don't want to be one of those CEOs trying to plant valuations out there.
Right. Okay.
You know, I guess to answer that question, I mean, I think that our involvement in the cannabis sector in general, I mean, I know there's all this focus on certain individuals, but I mean, I think we have a pretty good pedigree of people that are working with us, not just on cannabis side. I mean, we have some very, very astute organizations working with us. I guess to answer that question, I think the sector overall is just performing. I think we've moved out of the low, you know, the doldrums of the summer. And you know, with our recent note conversions, I do believe that's helped add liquidity, which was a mm-hmm. huge problem for us prior. So I think the combination of the sector moving, good press and liquidity have all contributed to you know, what we see today. But what the company should be valued at, I mean, that's up to the market to look. You know, I'd ask investors to just do their due diligence. Look at who we're working with. Look at the technology we developed. You know, it is real. The people we're working with are real, and you know, value the company as they see fit.
So I'm looking at the chart, and it's gone from, you know, the 25 cent to 30 cent range for most of September, early October, to now where it's 65. A lot of companies in the marijuana space have had similar trajectories over the last few weeks, but it really seems like maybe, from how I look at it, Indoor Harvest is maybe being held down a little bit, and in the last week or so, you know, that hold has been taken off. Would that be a fair assessment, do you think?
Yeah, again, I think that, you know, again, and I've said this publicly several times and in previous conference calls, that one of our biggest problems had been liquidity. I mean, mm-hmm. we were one of the handful of companies that did an actual SPO, or secondary public offering.
Mm-hmm.
So we had very, you know, the only way to have liquidity in the market was for one of our original shareholders to sell stock. So we did suffer for a good long period of time with minimal liquidity. And you know, I think that's changed as a result of the...
It's a very tight float for an OTC company. I'm seeing 12 million shares.
Yeah. I mean, we still have exactly. I've been very proud of our management of equity given the obstacles that we've had to deal with. But
uh-huh.
yeah, again, a small float company generally has to struggle with liquidity.
Yeah.
And we had that problem, and that, now we have pretty good liquidity. Mean, our liquidity is increased dramatically.
So certainly picking up, yeah.
I think that's helping us. Yeah, that's helping us more than most things, I would imagine.
So if you look at cannabis right now as a market, I mean, obviously, the jump over the last month has been very strongly related to the U.S. election and the California referendum. But, you know, as California goes up, do you see that being the high watermark for a while, or do you think there's going to be more Californias every few months just going forward for the next few years?
Well, from an industry perception point of view, mm-hmm. I mean, California is one of the largest economies. I mean, it's up there in the same size of economy as certain nation states. So mm-hmm. It's a large economy. So I would imagine, you know, there's that saying, you know, when California goes, so does the rest of the nation. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's sort of driving it, sort of that sort of mentality is driving a lot of the surge, is this hope that California will pass their propositions and things like that. again, I'm following what the DEA and FDA are doing in terms of regulatory environment.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly think that regardless of the hype in the sector and what people want to do in the state, that what's really going to dictate the future of the cannabis industry is what the federal government decides to do.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And I think that's still very much unknown at this point.
I would imagine that whoever wins the election, you know, the pressure is going to be on to finally let marijuana be. You know, I can't imagine with the amount of money that's being made in taxes in certain places that every other state isn't going to look at that and say we would like some of that too.
Well, I mean, it's the rule of law, and you know, I'm no fan of overregulation or anything like that. But if you read the law under the Controlled Substance Act, you know, like certain, you know, presidential candidates have claimed they'll reschedule cannabis. That's great, but rescheduling cannabis just simply means it's rescheduled under the Controlled Substance Act.
Right.
And I mean, we don't sell opioids in dispensaries. While people beat up the government for what it's doing in some strange way, I can understand it from a rule of law point of view, in that there are rules and laws on the books, and they have to, regardless of how poorly they're written,
mm-hmm.
they still have to be abide by. And so there's a process in the under the federal government to move product for medical use. There's a process for that. And what the federal government has recently done is open that process. But it's in the language of that. When you read the bulletin that was put out by the DEA, they don't necessarily make it they don't really seem to be interested in working with the existing cannabis industry. They
mm-hmm.
they go so far as to say that if you've been in violation of the Controlled Substance Act, that you know, your application is going to be scrutinized quite hard.
Yeah, which is the same as what happened in Canada.
And you're not guaranteed. Yeah. The difference in Canada, though, is they had the MMAR, which set legal precedent, which allowed them to take that back to the court.
Right. The powers that be still look at the MMAR as even though it was sort of court mandated, they see it as something that is racked with opportunists and people who may have been making a career out of weed for a long time and just not get caught. So they still have this sort of attitude of, if you're in the MMAR, you're going to really struggle to get the MMPR or the AMC, whatever it is now.
At the end of the day, ultimately the way I look at that is it's a legal precedent situation there. So they passed a law to satisfy a need at one point, and then the government came back and decided they wanted to rein that in. But that legal precedent was set. And the only thing that I'm really stating here is that kind of legal precedent does not exist currently in the United States.
Right.
So,
and these things tend to be. If the FDA, you know, decides tomorrow that OxyContin needs better labeling, it still takes a couple of years for that to actually move through the process. You know, making an industry like marijuana legal and regulated on a federal level is going to take a lot of time, I would imagine.
It's going to take a lot of time, and I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of costs involved to whoever wants to do it and pursue it.
Right.
But ultimately, my personal view is that you know, the government is opening up the research. It is, through its own language, saying it's going to restrict access to that pipeline, to get into that queue if you're an existing producer. So, you know, you've already got that struggle there. But if you can get into the queue there and get licensed, you are on the pathway towards, you know, basically, I think the federal government wants somebody to take the right pathway through the FDA the way that any other drug would go, so that they can get, under the rule of law, get the data and the research that they need to then go and reschedule. I don't think it's a lot of politicians wanting to not make it happen. I think that the problem is just the way the Controlled Substance Act and the way that the FDA rules have been written.
Got it.
I think it's a problem of interpretation of the law. You know?
In the meantime, I've often heard people who are in the farming space, the agri space, saying that marijuana is well and good, there's money to be made, but there are regular old legal crops that from a margin perspective and a yield perspective make you pretty much the same amount of money. Is that the case, or is that bullshit? Like, are strawberries going to do as well as cannabis if they're done in enough of a yield?
No, I, 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 I think the margins are still pretty good. I mean, I think even in the worst markets, cannabis is still fetching about $1,500 a pound at least. Uh-huh. So, I mean, I haven't checked numbers recently, but I don't think you're going to get $1,500 for a pound of strawberry. So,
right.
There's no doubt there's a higher margin in cannabis. But I will say that I think that the price of cannabis could be a lot cheaper. And I think that ultimately, if it becomes a commodity crop or it becomes a federally legal or whatever the case may be, you're going to see, you know, more advanced technologies be deployed at scale, mm-hmm. large scale, to manufacture the product at a low cost.
Got it.
And like I said, it's going to have to become legal first, federally, before you see that kind of scale come in.
Sure. So if you're looking forward now to indoor harvest and what the next few quarters we're going to likely roll out with, from what I'm getting from you, you're not expecting revenue to pop off the scale. You've got a long pipeline that requires things to happen both on your side but also on your client side. And accounting-wise, you know, the money that's in there is not necessarily booked yet. But how does it look, do you think, two quarters down the line? Like, what are you seeing as a sensible, conservative estimate of where you think indoor harvest will be?
I do believe that we'll be getting cash flow positive by the end of this year.
Okay.
Probably heading into the first quarter. So we should be getting cash flow positive in the next quarter, maybe two quarters if we have some delays with the winter construction schedule. Going into mid next year, a lot of this has to do with when the projects start and how they go. But if the projects kick off in early spring, I mean, we could be looking at anywhere between, you know, $3 to $5 million in revenue by the second quarter, depending on the draw schedules and things like that. But that's just based on what we have signed. We actually have projects are continuously coming to us, and mm-hmm. you know, some of them are too small. We just have to turn them down because they're just not big enough. But
mm-hmm.
There's potential that some bigger projects are going to come in and actually get started before some of the contracts we've already got signed. So the deal flow is there. There's no doubt in my mind we have the deal flow. It's just getting them going, getting them started. But some of the bigger contracts, you know, we're looking at probably first, second quarter,
mm-hmm.
and before we start generating the revenue. But on the engineering side and all that, with the pipeline that we do have and the portfolio we do have, just on the engineering side, we should start to see cash flow positive probably by first quarter.
And I'm guessing that Rafici was looking at that when he made his investment, but I'm imagining also his ability to put other companies together. You know, he's very big in Aurora, he was in Canopy, he's got investments in a few other things that are coming out. What do you think is the scope going on after you've done your Canopy pilot project? Like, do you think that catapults you into a serious sector in Canada in terms of the other LPs and the potential to work together, or is it still a little bit sort of like they're just testing the waters?
Well, I think it'll definitely change the perception. I mean, one of the things that we face as a vertical farming company is that, like I mentioned earlier, we don't have a big, huge farm I can point to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can't say, here's our big 20,000 square foot farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so investors like to see things. They like to see assets. They like to see that you've done things, right?
Mm-hmm.
The difference with us is we don't have a farm I can point to
yet.
But what I can point to is a lot of R&D data that those guys don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, the equipment and processes that we're developing have already made those guys obsolete. So, and it's a lot harder to see that. You follow me? I mean, if you're in a
business,
it's a lot harder to see that. So
sure.
I'm not going to speak to Mr. Rafici's decisions or whatever the case may be, but I would imagine he's a little more, a little more informed as to what's going on
mm-hmm.
in terms of just the sophistication of his knowledge of the industry and where it's headed.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's the value he sees. Again, he's one of many of our investors. We have a lot of really great investors.
Sure.
So,
sure.
And that's the other thing too. You know, a big chunk of the company is my friends and family. So, you know, we mm-hmm. we do have a good, nice, strong family pool of investors here. But yeah, to answer your question, I mean, I do believe that once we can actually validate the technology in an economic pilot where we're producing it at using the commercial standard process we developed, everything that we've done up until this point has really just been prototype testing in small batches.
Right.
And so what we're deploying now is we're taking all that knowledge that we gained and we're now deploying an actual commercial system that's fully developed. And then the results of that will speak for themselves. And then people can determine when they estimate out or the CapEx and OpEx, whether there's a value there. And again, all I will say is there's a huge interest in this technology in the food production side. MIT has really put a lot of time and effort into you know, exploring the technology, as have others. So, you know, I mean, our very first prototype test that we ever did, right off the bat, very first test we ever did, we produced a quarter pound head of lettuce in 28 days for the speed in your hand and only used 2 gallons to produce it.
Wow.
So that's where we started. That's where we started. And today, okay, a lot of what we've done has not been made public. And I think that ultimately that when we're able to get a lot of that data out there and let people understand what the technology can do, I do believe the perceptions will change.
And as your projects get through the design, engineering, and then construction phase and start to actually launch, then you will have, presumably, farms that you can point to.
We will have an entire... Exactly. In other words, we'll go from an obscure company the peers in our industry and the major players in our industry, they all know who we are.
Uh-huh.
We have good relationships with a lot of them. It's just the general market out there is not as aware of Indoor Harvest because we haven't gotten a lot of third-party press coverage because we don't have that big, cool farm to point to. You know,
I think probably there's also a lot of... There's a lot of people who are sort of looking at vertical farming as being one of those things that someone's going to make a lot of money out of, and then once that happens, then they'll get in there. But maybe they're sort of looking at that industry as still being just a little bit too nascent, to, especially when weed companies are doubling and tripling.
I would agree, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I would agree with that. It is by no means, it's still definitely a nascent industry. I mean, we're learning things every day. I mean, every day we're learning something new and changing our designs and new technology is coming out. So it's constantly evolving. And I would agree, there's not one group that has produced the perfect business plan for vertical farming yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's technology holding it back. That's the one thing I do want to say, is it's not technology holding it back. It's just proper scale and infrastructure investment. That's what the core problem is, because you've got the smaller vertical farming guys that make up most of the industry, and they're just not building to a scale that makes it efficient, because it is expensive. There's absolutely no doubt that the vertical farming is capital intensive.
But so is real estate.
So is real estate, exactly. And so is climate change, and so is pollution in the environment. There's going to be places around the world where the only way you're going to be able to grow non-polluted fresh food is going to be in a sealed environment.
Sure. Bananas is a commercial crop being destroyed across the world because they all come from the same DNA, and those that you get in the supermarket, you know, they're sprayed with all sorts of chemicals to stop them from ripening and then start them ripening, and then they last 3 days on your shelf as a result of it. So I can see the potential for this going forward in a big way.
Yeah, and again, I don't, you know, a lot gets focused on food, and again, I can't say enough about the pharmaceutical side, and I'm not just talking about cannabis here. We're talking about all sorts of vaccines and antibiotics can be plant-derived.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the most expensive vertical farms ever built was built by DARPA here in Texas to produce the H1 and Ebola vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So they were plant-based derived from a tobacco plant.
Okay.
So there's a huge opportunity on the plant sciences side. And just one of the unique things about our particular technology that's completely different than a lot of other production methods is if you're doing a hydroponic or a drip irrigation production method, you don't have a lot of precision control over the nutrients the plant's getting. I mean, you can set your baselines, but you're never going to be able to keep complete control over the micronutrients and things like that. There's always going to be a flux. Mm-hmm. it's going to change. with our system, you know, in the layman's terms, the best way I can explain our system is it operates like the fuel injection on your car. We can take biofeedback from the plants using new advanced sensor technology, and we can see how that plant's responding. And just like the engine management system on your car, it's detecting the oxygen and the CO2 levels and then adjusting the mixture to make the engine run happy. Well, we can do the same thing with our platform in plant production. Mm. And that's where the shining point is really going to be, is what science is showing at this point is, like a lot of the big pharmaceutical groups out there, they're extracting certain chemicals and they're isolating them and they're using them for pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing, like, for example, with cannabis, is that the entire entourage effect, the terpenoids, the cannabinoids, all of that combined create this effect that you just can't get when you isolate certain compounds. So where our technology can really come into play on the pharmaceutical side, which is ultimately what we're trying to pursue on mm-hmm. our high-pressure side of our business, is to be able to go to researchers and producers and say, we can repeatedly, consistently produce this broad chemical expression profile from the single genetic that you're using, as opposed to just isolating compounds and hope they work. So that really is the key aspect to what our technology can achieve, that all these other production methods, really, you can't fine precision feed the plant. Mm-hmm. And our system literally operates like fuel injection. So we're feeding the plant precise amounts each time, every time. There's no recirculation. We don't recapture water. There's no anything like that. So it's a consistent, constant supply of the exact same environmental conditions. And over time, you apply that sensor technology to figure out the environmental conditions the plant needs to be grown in. Temperature, humidity, lighting spectrum, nutrients, all of that plays into the chemical profile that plant produces. And this is not just for cannabis. This is for any plant.
Yeah, sure.
So what we're learning, it's very early research. I mean, this is, you know, NASA did a lot of this stuff in the 90s, mm-hmm. but it was done on a smaller scale, and now technology is getting us with LEDs and things like that. It's becoming more able to scale commercially.
Do you think we'll get to a point where we'll be able to backward scale that, so that, you know, a person living in a 400-square-foot condo could have their wall of plants to essentially feed their family? Is the home market a good market?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I'm not in that market. I couldn't tell you. But I do know there's a demand for people that want to have fresh produce.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's definitely the countertop grow systems are real popular and things like that. But, yeah, there's definitely groups. You know, it's like Grove Labs comes to mind. That's developing at MIT. They're developing kitchen appliances mm-hmm. to grow your food. So there's a lot out there, and definitely, you know, at the end of the day, it's about the data though. You got to have the data to develop these platforms.
Sure.
And but yeah, it's already happening. People are already taking the sensor technologies that are being developed and applying them to the smaller scale.
You've come a long way from stacking microgreens and selling them to restaurants. Like it's like factory farming, but for plants, you know?
Yeah, it's about producing consistency, high quality consistency, because the restaurants out there, their biggest problem right now is sourcing consistent quality.
Mm-hmm.
And that is their problem, ultimately. And then, of course, you have to deal with the commodity markets and the prices going up and down. You can now go to a restaurant and say, I can provide you a consistent quality of the exact same flavor, texture, and appearance year-round, and I can do it at a fixed price. My price is not going to fluctuate up and down because it's a completely controlled environment that you're producing it in.
Right.
You know, as long as the price of electricity doesn't go up and things like that, you're able to maintain... You're able to provide that restaurant or that customer, you know, he'll be able to do his cash flow analysis a whole lot easier. Mm-hmm. He knows his cost, and not only that, but he doesn't have to worry about whether he's getting a bad batch of cilantro in or not.
I used to own a restaurant. I always tell people when we go out for dinner, you know, when the specials come around, I'm always like, just quietly, like, when something's on special, it means either it's been sitting in the fridge too long or they've got a really shitty batch that they need to get rid of, like, leave the specials alone.
I do not believe vertical farming is at a point yet to where we can do large scale, you know, food production to help feed the hungry masses. You know, it's not there yet. I think mm-hmm. that we're still years away from developing those technologies at scale. I do believe at some point it's going to be needed in certain geographic locations.
Mm-hmm.
It's a burgeoning market, no doubt, and we are ultimately at the beginning of it.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad I bought some stock before I talked to you. Thanks for chatting with me. I appreciate the insight. I've written a little bit about AGS, which is also in the indoor space, over the last few months, and they've certainly had their big spike. Afanor is always throwing news releases out there about how great their strawberries are going to be. But it's a confusing space for a lot of people, so I really appreciate you taking the time to explain the ins and outs. And I hope we can catch up again in a few months and see where you're at.
Definitely appreciate the call and anytime, man.
Excellent. Thanks very much. That's Chad Sykes from Indoor Harvest. That's INQD on the OTC.
You've been listening to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look. See you next time.